Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young. And coming up, we'll go to Buffalo, New York. We'll hear about that historic snowstorm.
But first, news today that we will hear from President Obama tomorrow on the issue of immigration. The president is expected to unveil executive orders that he says he's been considering because Congress hasn't passed comprehensive immigration reform. The orders are expected to shield up to 5 million undocumented people from being deported, and we'll hear more on that as the details come out. But we want to check in now on how this debate is playing out in one Nebraska city, Fremont, Nebraska, about 30 miles outside of Omaha. It's one of a handful of towns in the U.S. trying to restrict illegal immigration because of an influx of immigrants. Joining us is the mayor of Fremont, Scott Getchman. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what would an executive order on immigration from the president mean for life in Fremont?
You know, I'm not real sure that it's going to make a huge difference immediately. I think it would, along with many other citizens in not only Fremont, but in the United States, I think it would frustrate some due to the fact that I think some people feel more should be done in regards to the laws that we have in place. And so they may look at this as, you know, a way of not taking care of the situation in the manner that they would feel it should be taken care of.
But you do have an estimated 1,500 people now living in Fremont illegally. That's out of a population of, what, less than 30,000?
Yeah, we're, you know, the number is probably closer to 1,000. And we have probably 3,000 Hispanics living in Fremont, and our population's about 24,000. You know, those residents that are here have to abide by the ordinance that we have in place in Fremont, which is a housing ordinance, which if they're going to rent an apartment, they would have to get a renter's license and supply that to their landlord. And so basically that is one of the requirements. And then if they're going to work in Fremont, which is the other thing, any business in Fremont has to use E-Verify to verify the legality of the employee they're hiring.
And by the way, you opposed that housing ordinance and you faced a recall election over your opposition to that.
Yeah, and a lot of that had to do with the fact that I truly felt that it wasn't fair that the citizens of Fremont be burdened with the costs of enforcement and the costs of defense of this ordinance, while at the same time we have laws on the books that should be handling the immigration process already.
You sound like you're trying to be very careful with your words on this issue, that you've got people on both sides of this issue living in Fremont and that you don't want to really offend either one of them.
I will tell you that this is immigration is a difficult issue because it takes logical people and it puts them on both sides of the fence. And, you know, so it's difficult for everyone, and it's been more difficult for Fremont. We're the only community in the United States that has an ordinance similar to this housing ordinance that's in effect today.
So would you prefer that President Obama just leave the situation as it is at this moment, or would you prefer that he take executive action and legalize a number of people living in this country illegally?
I truly feel that before you would do a blanket amnesty, you must, to go any further, you have to seal the borders. And we've not done that. And so this is a Band-Aid approach to immigration reform. And truly, I don't feel it's a solution to the problem.
But what if Congress is not going to act and do what you're saying and increase security along the border and make a pathway to citizenship for people who are here illegally. This was something that the Senate did act on in a bipartisan way, but the House refused to take up. So if there's no action from Congress, you would still prefer that President Obama leave the situation as is?
You know, I think he's going to do whether I want what I want or don't want. But again, I think the key thing for this to be structured properly would be to enforce the border laws, and then at that point, you know, you got to take a hard look at blanket amnesty or how that's going to happen and take effect. But it will affect our country, and again, there are legal Hispanics in our community that truly add value, and I would assume there's Hispanics that are illegal that are also working hard and providing value to our community. And then there's some that probably do drain our economy to a certain extent.
Well, what would it mean for your economy if those people were legal as opposed to illegal in Fremont?
I would say that it's in all reality, we've not had an influx of Hispanics. So I would say our economy would stay stable or grow slightly.
That's Scott Getchman, the mayor of Fremont, Nebraska. Mr. Getchman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you and have a great day.
Well, let's turn now to the weather. Terrible weather in upstate New York. A huge storm has left 6 people dead. Up to 6 feet of snow has fallen around the city of Buffalo, stranding drivers and trapping people in their homes. New York's governor has declared a state of emergency in several counties. Earlier today, we spoke to Buffalo Mayor Byron Brown. He told us how the road clearing is going.
We are making progress, but it's a slow go with much more work to do. We're aware of that. We've asked our residents to be patient. They are being patient. We're known as the City of Good Neighbors. Buffalo has risen to this occasion as it has done many times in the past.
Well, let's go now to Brian Meyer, news director at WBFO in Buffalo. And Brian, what's it look like out there today?
Well, actually, a big chunk of the city is actually quite nice for, you know, pre-winter. I mean, we don't have loads of snow in most of the city proper. South Buffalo was really pummeled. In fact, that's where a driving ban has been imposed for a good time now. And points south are where you're seeing those, you know, measurable inches in the, 60-inch range. But right now, looking out the window in my office, it actually looks like a rather nice day without a lot of snow on the ground here in downtown Buffalo.
Well, that's good news. You attended a press conference this morning. There were local officials there. What did they have to say?
Well, you talked about the 6 confirmed dead in storm-related incidents, including a 46-year-old man who was found in his car in a Buffalo suburb, the car buried in between 10 and 15 feet of snow, and that's exactly what people are saying. The officials are saying you've got to stay off the roads. There are driving bans now in nearly 20 communities surrounding Buffalo and in part of Buffalo, the southern part of Buffalo.
Well, let's hear some of that press conference. Here we have Erie County Deputy Executive Richard Toby. Let's give a listen to what he says.
The biggest challenges continue to be vehicles abandoned on the roads. And one of the greatest frustrations have been vehicles beginning to move and getting stranded.
So basically, it sounds like he's urging people to just stay inside.
Well, absolutely. I mean, their point being that, you know, driving in so many parts of Western New York is treacherous. And true, we are, you know, pretty good at driving in wintry weather here in Western New York. But it is just very tricky. I know I went and covered that 6 a.m. news conference, and it really wasn't snowing all that much. And it still was very difficult, particularly when you're trying to navigate roads where there were all kinds of plows on the road. Because now, you know, we've got pretty significant snow fighting brigades here, but we have been beefed up substantially. The National Guard is in. Helping us. Mm. We've got crews from all over parts of Western New York, and the state sent in 160 plows. So you've got these snow brigades trying to get snow off of streets, and you've got drivers who are, you know, obeying the traffic bans, and that's not a good ingredient.
And the crazy thing about this, you know, some people are just frankly stuck in their houses. Earlier today, we spoke with Kathy Romanowski. She's in Buffalo. She's just completely snowed in.
I have several feet of snow right in front of my door that when I try to open it, I keep my snow shovel inside of my house so that way I can start to chip away at the snow as I try to get out my side door. So it is pretty, you know, encompassing.
I don't know. Are people used to this kind of weather? I mean,
not this ferocious. I've been through five storms as a reporter. I've been reporting here in Buffalo for 33 years, and I've been through five major storms. Of course, you know, I was a little too young. I was a high school student with the infamous blizzard of 77, which put us on everyone's radar screen. But this, I have to say, is pretty, pretty substantial. And the fact is, it's not over yet. We are still hearing that we're going to be getting some lake effect snows for the next day or so. Then we've got, after the snow trauma, if you will, we've got warmer temperatures over the weekend, particularly on Sunday. If all this melts, and it melts really fast, we have what could be the equivalent of 6 inches of rain. So you may have as many flooding issues as you do snow issues 4 or 5 days from now.
So take a minute, if you could, to explain this lake effect snow, because I don't think people who don't live in this area, they probably have no idea what this is, or they've just only heard of it before.
Well, for Western New Yorkers, it's weather 101. When the chilly winds kind of blow over a warmer lake mass, think of, you know, Lake Erie or some of the other great lakes, it picks up water vapor. Of course, what happens in cold weather, that vapor freezes, and then, well, the rest is, I guess, what Western New York's weather legacy is made of, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what about some other rescue workers, essential employees, hospital employees, firefighters? Are they doing okay?
Yeah, that's been tough. Some nurses I've heard have been staying overnight. Of course, many of them are working in double shifts. Many of the, you know, treacherous road conditions have not stopped a lot of people from very carefully driving to their workplaces. And I'm talking about the essential personnel, the emergency folks and the nurses and doctors and so forth. Still others have, you know, basically begged rides from folks with four-wheel drive vehicles. And you can imagine those are pretty popular vehicles here in this region.
Yeah, well, Brian, I hope that your staff, your reporters are able to get out there and do their jobs. Brian Meyer, news director of WBFO in Buffalo, thanks for your time and good luck.
Thank you.
And Peter, there's this Twitter hashtag now, Snowvember,
right,
where people are posting photos. This one right here that I'm looking at is, as we heard from Kathy Romanowski, people have their doors snowed in, several feet of snow in front of the door. The one I'm looking at right now, somebody has created a refrigerator in the snow with shelves. It looks like beers on one level and energy drinks on the one below.
Winter paradise.
Winter paradise for some in Buffalo. Of course, for some, it's a very dangerous situation. 3 years ago this month, assistant Penn State football coach Jerry Sandusky was arrested on child sex abuse charges. His arrest triggered the firing of Penn State's legendary head football coach Joe Paterno. Sandusky was later convicted and will probably spend the rest of his life in prison. Joe Paterno died just a few months after he was fired. The new film Happy Valley reveals the raw feelings that still linger today at Penn State. The director is Amir Bar-Lev. He's with us from New York. And Amir, tell us first why you decided to make this film, because it is a familiar story.
The thing that drew me to this story, I have to say, was not Jerry Sandusky. The people around him are far more compelling. The people who failed these kids, and certainly when we showed up to Happy Valley, to State College, where Penn State is, nicknamed Happy Valley, there was a lot of finger-pointing going on. There was one school of thought saying, this is a story about one man, a perpetrator, and it shouldn't be about the rest of us. And then the rest of the country was pointing the finger at all of Happy Valley, saying, what a rotten place. They love football too much.
Well, and the interesting thing is that you've got people from all different perspectives with these very raw emotions. You're not telling just one side of the story.
It's a story that wants to be told from a bunch of different perspectives. And I have to confess, I find them all very compelling. We have the Paterno family, you know, who point out that their father and husband had 61 years of fighting for kids, basically. You know, he always said football was stupid unless it was in service of something higher than that. And, you know, they have the perspective that those 61 years shouldn't be thrown away just by this one incident at the end of his life. And then there are other people who have a very different perspective. And it's one of those questions that, you know, there's maybe not one right answer to. And so we crossed over this kind of ideological divide in Happy Valley over the course of 2 years many, many times and spoke to a variety of different people.
Well, and let's hear from some of them. This is one of the characters we hear a lot from in your film. This is Matt Sandusky, Jerry Sandusky's adopted son, and he says he was abused by Jerry Sandusky.
I had to be loyal. I was loyal to the family. I wasn't going to betray anybody. I wasn't going to betray him. And in the end, here I sit, betrayed by them all.
And then there are the Paternos. This is Jay Paterno, who is Joe Paterno's son, who is a Penn State assistant coach. Let's listen to a clip from him.
The truth is, this is not a Penn State issue. It's not a Joe Paterno issue. This is a Jerry Sandusky issue.
We also hear from Joe Paterno's wife. There's a scene in the film where a crew is removing the Joe Paterno statue from the campus, and his wife, Sue, now his widow, is speaking. Let's listen.
I see now that society likes to destroy what they think is better than they are. You know, everybody who worked in the football program, it was a family. Everybody cared about each other. And everybody cared about how everybody else did. We had Camelot.
How do you see the Paternos in this story? Because there's a Sandusky story, there's a Penn State story, there are all these different storylines. There are the victims, there are the students at Penn State who were impacted by this. But the Paternos have a unique place in this story.
Yeah, well, they're really what initially drew me to this story. And, you know, in some ways it's a story about Joe Paterno, but in a lot of ways it's more about who we as a culture wanted Joe Paterno to be. I mean, there's an interview segment in the film, a piece of archival from some years back, where an interviewer says, "How does it feel to be the beacon of integrity to Joe Paterno?" And he says, "Oh, that's a little scary. Don't call me that." Mm. And I think, you know, Joe Paterno was given sainthood status. I don't think he was ever very comfortable with that status. And when he didn't live up to that, you know, we were all too eager as a culture to blame him for not living up to our own projection.
Well, and we were all too eager as a culture to get wrapped up in this game of football and this incredible team to realize what was going on right in front of us.
It's a film, you know, with two bad guys, so to speak. You know, obviously Jerry Sandusky is a villain in this story. But as I said, I'm less interested in him than the bad guy of the crowd, the mob. You know, you see the mob attacking people for criticizing Joe Paterno. You see the mob attacking Joe Paterno. And, you see it in the way the NCAA kind of created this shaming spectacle around Penn State, accusing them of having too much passion for football. Well, guess what? That the NCAA is just as guilty of that as Penn State. We're all guilty of that as Americans. So it's a story about a kind of a lynch mob mentality that existed both pro and against Penn State.
Did you find that the town has recovered now, 3 years later?
I don't think that the town will ever recover, I mean, in the sense that I'm interested in the sense of its own identity. Football fans at Penn State were different than other football fans because Joe Paterno gave them a sense that they were about something higher, something more important than winning games. And, you know, that sense has been indelibly impacted, I would say.
Well, you even focus on a student who was a huge Penn State football fan who was very frustrated by the scandal and how it had tarnished the football program, ended up leaving the school. Let's listen to a clip of him.
I hate how every time I have to share my opinion about Penn State football and what happened, I have to say I feel bad for the victims. I mean, that should just be like common sense for anyone. Yeah, you feel bad. But now with anybody who's not associated with, I have to say that just to make sure that they don't think I'm some kind of idiot that doesn't care about that kind of stuff.
What do you think this whole event that happened and captured the attention of the nation back in 2011, what do you think it says about our culture?
Well, it says something about heroes, but it also says something, I think, about spectacle and distraction. And you know, I can tell you very often I come in to the end of the film where I'm going to do a Q&A at a film festival, say, and I see people texting in the last scene because, you know, they've realized the film's almost over. They need to get back to connectivity. And it's a pity because the final scene is a beautiful soliloquy by a Penn State film professor named Matt Jordan about distraction, about spectacle. And what I don't want, you know, what I'm hoping for this film, what I don't want is for people to walk away from it and say, well, you know, the lesson there is football is a horrible thing. You know, football is one way we distract ourselves to death here in this country. And there are many other ways. I think that it was a kind of an oversimplistic read of what went wrong in Happy Valley to think that this could be blamed only on big football and money and sort of Penn State's brand. I think it's actually quite it's much more insidious. I think we failed those kids by kind of willingly turning away from them in a way that is all too easy these days.
Amir Bar-Lev, the new film, and it's a fascinating documentary, is called Happy Valley. It's about Penn State and the Jerry Sandusky case. You can see where it's playing at our website, hereandnow.org. It opens today in New York. Amir, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
JetBlue announced today it will no longer offer free checked bags, leaving just one major airline without a bag fee. Oh, and that extra legroom on JetBlue, it's gone too.
CNN's Maggie Lake joins us to explain what is behind this. And by the way, Southwest is the, I guess, last airline left without a bag fee. Maggie, why is this happening?
Yeah, they are trying to please investors. That's what's going on. They've been under pressure to try to get those profit margins up. But as we could, I think we've all figured out by now, what's good for shareholders is not necessarily good for the flying public. And it's coming in the guise of all of these fees. And now these extra seats makes you want to run right out and buy an airline ticket, doesn't it?
Well, why aren't consumers, say like a 6'2" consumer like myself, why don't they carry more sway in the marketplace than investors?
Well, listen, because I think ultimately we're so price sensitive, right? It's still a tough economy. You know, with consolidation, fares have been going up. We're all trying to find the best fare. So we seem to be willing to put up with a great deal of inconvenience if that low fare we first see. Because remember, a lot of those fees get tacked on after in your total. If they can keep it on the low side, even with the fees, and everyone's doing it together as an industry, it's not leaving us much choice. I think it's until we stop choosing to fly, which isn't an option, that it's not going to put that pressure on the airlines.
Well, and I guess the other question would be, why did it take them so long? If you look at it from the other side, why did it take them so long to do this? The CEO of JetBlue, Dave Barger, who's stepping down next year, has long resisted calls from Wall Street to get rid of these free bags. Are we going to see more of this with the new CEO coming in?
I think that's a good question. Listen, at some point, we're going to figure out when all of these fees do start to alienate customers. You get the sense, if anybody's flown recently, you get the sense we're getting pretty close to that point where it's just not worth flying. You're willing to get in a car and drive much further than you would have. I don't know. This is what the new CEO is going to have to find out. Listen, investors would like them to give up the free Wi-Fi. I mean, there's no end to the fees. Investors would like to see these airlines tack on. It's at what point do they really start to suffer with customer satisfaction? I think that's going to be the real key here. And this could give Southwest an advantage. You know, I saw a hilarious post on one website talking about this today from someone who said, who will be the first bold capitalist that just stacks their passengers like cordwood? I mean, it is getting to that point.
And don't they do that already, right?
Yeah, exactly. It does feel like that already, especially with this legroom. And remember, it's not just the legroom. It's the combination, isn't it? It's the legroom with the baggage fees, which means everybody drags those roller carts on and throws them up there, and it takes so much longer. So the frustration level is building, but until they start to see that drop-off in bookings, we're probably not going to get any relief.
But you mentioned Southwest, last man standing in this for the bag fees now. How much pressure do they feel?
They probably feel a lot from shareholders, although I don't know. Here's the interesting thing. They have really made customer service their mission, and they're really starting to stand out, the only one left. If they're able to grab some market share away from those JetBlue customers, they may not feel the pressure, and they are one of the best-performing stocks right now, and that is helping. They're up something like 110%. The other ones are somewhere between 50 and 80% year-to-date. Those are very nice-looking gains, but Southwest is out ahead, so their investors are probably pretty happy with them right now. So one would imagine they're going to be able to hold on to that no bag fee and try to capitalize on it as a way to steal market share.
Hey, Maggie, we've all noticed that the gas prices are pretty low right now. Why hasn't that trickled down to fuel prices being low to airline fees going to airline prices, ticket prices going down?
You think it would. And again, it goes back to the fact that they want to boost their profit margins. They've been waiting a long time to be in this position. They're going to give it back to investors, shareholders. They're saving $31 million a week, some estimates say, on lower fuel costs. That's huge. Mm. But they're also, it looks like, trying to maybe buy some more fuel-efficient airlines and pump that money back into their business as well. So between those two things, not likely that we're going to see a break from that anytime soon.
CNN's Maggie Lake, thanks for sharing the news with us. ISIS, or the Islamic State, is in the market for oil industry workers to manage oil fields they've seized. The group was reportedly even advertising for managers on the black market and willing to pay $225,000 a year. The Times of London cited a source saying ISIS wants to recruit skilled professionals who are, quote, ideologically suitable. Oil, along with ransom and extortion, has made ISIS one of the wealthiest terrorist organizations in the world. But recently, there have been reports of problems at ISIS oil fields, including an explosion, which injured workers. Louay Al-Khatib is a visiting fellow of the Brookings Doha Center and the founder of the Iraq Energy Institute in London. He joins us via Skype. Louay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we know that ISIS has been successful recruiting fighters from places like Europe and other Western countries. But what are the chances that the Islamic State could realistically find somebody with those technical skills you're looking for?
Quite high, especially when we know that at least 30% of the foreign fighters are from Saudi Arabia. And there are plenty of people that worked with oil companies there. Most probably willing to join forces. I mean, we've seen doctors and people with various professions join the group over the past 3 months and even took part in the suicide bombing acts in Iraq. Mm. So finding engineers who sympathize with ISIS and basically join them to help their cause and it's very much possible. Over the past week or so, I saw pictures of engineers circulating in social networks. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that many petroleum engineers would have joined already and helping them to basically keep up the oil production in the various areas in Syria and Iraq.
Well, we're hearing a salary of $225,000 for whoever might be interested in this job. And I'm kind of afraid to even ask, is that a competitive wage?
Well, the incentives is not much of an influencing factors. What really attracts those people is the ideological and basically the cause. Right. It's a very much a sectarian war, and it will attract people with a sectarian tendencies to basically join these forces. Of course, financial incentives will add value to the whole package, but the reason behind it is ideological.
So these oil fields, obviously huge revenue generators for the Islamic State. Can you give us an idea how much are we talking about here? How much oil are they moving? Where is it going? Who's buying it?
Well, put it this way, whatever oil fields ISIS seized over the past, about since June in Iraq, the mostly marginal fields. But even those marginal fields can produce quite a significant production that could sustain such movement. So in Iraq, for example, since June, they seized oil fields with a capacity of 80,000 barrels. Having said that, they only managed to produce 20% to 25% of that capacity. Of course, after the U.S. airstrikes, the level of production been reduced. Having said that, the control of across the border in Syria continued to be intact. Yes, the U.S. airstrikes managed to hit a number of small rudimentary refineries, but the oil production continued there. I mean, we have to take into consideration that ISIS is in control of a territory the size of Austria and the stretch between two countries. And 60% of all the oil resources in Syria under the control of ISIS, being in the eastern part of Syria.
Wow. And we know that the money that they're generating is going to fund their activities. Can you put a dollar figure on what the production is?
Minimum of $2 million to $3 million.
Per day.
Per day. But even these cash flow contributes to purchasing refined products from Turkey and from adjacent regions. Mm. Also, the ISIS rely very much on importing products from Turkey. So they use all the cash flow they make.
Does the Islamic State have the equipment, the infrastructure, and the gear that's needed to sell and transport all of this oil to get it to market? How much of a challenge will that new employee face trying to get that stuff out?
So we're talking about from like the basically extraction of the oil into the transport, the refining facilities by using the mobile refineries. So there are a number of basically vacancies need to be filled. And I can imagine that they will need a lot of people to help them and train as we see them basically expanding in their territory. Having said that, winter will be their worst enemy. There will be an increase in demand. They need to provide supplies not only to the nearly 40,000 fighters, but also they are accountable to provide some supply to the people under their sway.
And that's who the customers are.
Their main customer base is the local, basically, and we are talking about around 8 million people.
So we've done stories that explain how the Islamic State is structured in many ways, like a functioning government. It has departments that resemble a cabinet system even. Last week, we saw the Islamic State talking about how they wanted to establish their own currency. As we see this, as we see more examples of this sort of thing, I wonder, do you think that we are in any way underestimating the growing presence and power of ISIS as a player?
Definitely. I mean, there is an underestimation of the growing of radical Islam, I would say. And ISIS is just becoming a brand of the extreme radical Islam that has been fueled by people from around the world, but most specifically countries that share the same similar school of thoughts. We've seen that the number of fighters are growing by the day. At least 50% of the fighters are basically from all over the world.
Louay Al-Khatib, a visiting fellow of the Brookings Doha Center and the founder of the Iraq Energy Institute, talking to us about the Islamic State's effort to find someone to help manage their oil fields. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Jeremy, I'm going to ask you to reveal a secret here. What's the one place in the United States you'd love to visit because so few other people know to go there?
You know, I like to find hikes that have nice views of the cities. And so when I lived in L.A., I used to go to Temescal Canyon, which is beautiful. And here in Boston, I like to go out to this place called Noinet Peak in Dover, Massachusetts.
I've not been there yet.
Well, don't go. It's my secret.
I will try not to. There's a good chance that for a lot of us, West Virginia is off the radar. Tour companies were at the state capitol this week in Charleston asking lawmakers to up West Virginia's profile around the country. A state program to fund advertising has fallen from $23 million in 2004 to less than $3 million this year. And that means potential tourists aren't as likely to hear TV spots like this one.
There is a place where getting away from it all means getting closer. Where being unplugged means you reconnect. A place where there truly is something for everybody. Find your wild and wonderful in West Virginia.
Those ads make a big difference to Dave Arnold's business. He co-owns a river rafting company called Adventures on the Gorge. And he was at the Capitol this week looking for help. Dave, welcome to Here Now.
Thank you.
And okay, so for people who aren't familiar with the rivers in West Virginia, explain, how good are they?
Well, we have a saying here that says it's America's best whitewater, and that is obviously a big claim, but it is arguable. So clearly the New and the Gauley Rivers, which are the two rivers we run, are two of the top five in the United States. You know, maybe the top six or seven, but clearly these are two of the best rivers in the United States for commercial whitewater.
And yet that hasn't necessarily helped all that much because there's been a big decline in the whitewater industry that's been happening over several years in West Virginia. How bad has it gotten?
Well, first off, you're right. It's amazing. How does a diamond fall apart? And especially the Gauley, which is one of the top three rivers in the United States as far as whitewater. You know, it is half the size it was 10 years ago in the number of people that go on the river. But we have seen a decline from somewhere around 225,000 people in the year 2000 to today, where we see about 100,000. So more than half of the people are now gone.
So that's a really big drop. I mean, what is it? Fewer people are interested in running rivers? You also think it might have something to do with the way the state is advertising West Virginia's rivers?
Well, as you would guess, we've spent a lot of time studying this because we've really been perplexed. And the conclusion we've come to is obviously that it's many, many things. Kids today spend more time on the computers. They're not turning over rocks and streams looking for crawdads, so they don't have the outdoor ethic that my generation grew up with. And then my generation is getting older and having hip replacements and knee surgeries, and so all this stuff's happening. We see a cultural change in America where there's more cultural diversity, and you know, some of the like Hispanic population maybe doesn't raft as much, and we just have to educate them that it's a great experience. All these things come into play. But by far, the number one reason is the lack of marketing, both in the industry and by the state of West Virginia.
So as we said, the state of West Virginia this year has less than $3 million dedicated to its advertising budget. But how do you know that makes a difference?
Well, we know because our own companies, we see it. When we cut back our advertising budgets, we see a huge decline. Not only that, but a number of companies have researched it over the years. Longwoods International is probably the top company in the world that does studying of tourism businesses, and they study it every year, why things decline, why they don't. And they've clearly also said that it's a marketing function.
Could you talk about these advertisements that work supposedly very well? When I turn on the TV in Pennsylvania, for instance, I might see a beautiful sweeping vista of West Virginia and its rivers or something like that, right? We've seen these before.
There's always somebody that's doing it really well. You know, for years, Virginia's for Lovers was a great campaign. Really, the soup du jour in the tourism industry, at least in the Mid-Atlantic region today, is Pure Michigan. So you see Michigan going after really authentic experiences with really emotional 30-second commercials, whether it's radio, whether it's TV, but they're going for your heart. And what they're finding is not only does it bring people to Michigan to play, but they also come for second homes, retirement, workforce, all kinds of things. So the benefits are multiple.
And Michigan, of course, a state that was hit hard, Rust Belt area, you know, the automotive industry looking for new ways to bring energy into the state. But I've got to ask, Dave, why should the state be responsible for doing this? If I own a solar company, I'm not going to expect the state to run advertising on my behalf.
Well, you know, I think this is one of the things that most people in America don't know. I'll make a statement here that I'm pretty confident of. There is no tourism business in the United States that does not have some type of government subsidy helping them grow. And somebody might be surprised by that, but the reason why I'm so confident in that is every state has Pure Michigan, Virginia's for Lovers, Wild and Wonderful. All states have some type of promotional mechanism for small business, for tourism small business. So it's part of the game. And when it becomes part of the game, if your state is not playing the game well, then you get hurt. So we're surrounded by states that have very large, very aggressive marketing budgets. Ohio, Michigan, Virginia, our big markets, places where people are, you know, looking to come whitewater rafting for a mountain experience, they are getting bombarded with other messages that are, you know, partly paid for, but with state monies.
And it is true. When I think about West Virginia, I'll be honest, I don't really think of a place to go on vacation. I wonder if you think because of this, West Virginia has a bit of an image problem.
You know, we've studied that a lot here. And I've been in business since 1977 here. I've also chaired the State Tourism Commission. So I've been privy to a lot of the data. And we always thought in West Virginia that we had a bad image, that we had a classic Appalachian image, you know, no shoes, no brains. We were very pleasantly surprised that what we found out is that actually there was no image at all. It's not unusual at all for somebody to say, oh, yeah, I've been to Richmond before, and I have to tell them. I say, Richmond's in another state.
Wrong state,
you know,
right.
That's Virginia. You know, oh, there's two, yeah. So that's an opportunity, and it's a problem. So the difference of whether it's an opportunity or a problem is marketing.
Yeah, well, in a way, this isn't about whitewater rafting. It's really a big picture, I imagine, about West Virginia's economy, too. You know, coal severance taxes are down, for instance. How do all these things fit together?
You know, I've always said this, Peter, that you do not want a state to be dependent on tourism or a city or a county. But what you do want is tourism as part of your mix. To me, it's a lot like art. You know, if you're going to have art in a city, art in a community, it just makes it stronger. It makes it more interesting. It's the same way with tourism. You need to have a strong tourism background. It's assuming you have product, which we have amazing product. So if you have that as part of your diversified economy, it makes everything else more interesting, whether it's coal, timber, you know, whether it's high tech, whatever. A great tourism economy just puts a little bit of spice in life and makes the city, the community, the county, the state more interesting.
Dave Arnold co-owns Adventures on the Gorge. He joined us from Charleston, West Virginia. Dave, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Peter.
And there is a reason why West Virginia isn't investing much in tourism marketing. The state's tourism commissioner, Amy Goodwin, told me West Virginia is projecting a $260 million budget shortfall. Her own department just took a nearly 8% cut. So Goodwin says her priority is funding research to tell her where to direct advertising money.
We have so few dollars to spend that we need the research in our hands to make sure. I can always guess on where I think the best place to put our money is. But what I really need is research to make sure that every single dollar that we spend in the future for the state of West Virginia has a significant return on investment.
Goodwin says the tourism department didn't have a Facebook page or a Twitter account until 6 months ago. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.